Brunn modified her fluffhead persona just slightly the next main shift. She appeared at the crew hostel without the pink-tipped spiky hairstyle, opting for a swept-back poof instead, all the pink ends hidden under an elaborate ribbon arrangement. She wore a more conservative outfit, something she might have worn a year ago in like circumstance. Her heart was pounding. She hoped that she'd find young Sirkin in the hostel lounge, and not Captain Serrano. She liked Captain Serrano, but it was a strain trying to impress her, knowing she wasn't going to succeed, having to try anyway. Sirkin and another crew member, a blonde woman with sleepy green eyes, waited at the desk. Brunn barely remembered Sirkin. The slender, dark-haired figure was only vaguely familiar. The other she didn't know at all.
Cam Serrano had other things to do this morning. I'm Methlin Mahari, and this is Briggs Sirkin. Captain said we should escort you to the storage company.
Yes, well.
She had planned to ask Sirkin to call her Brunn, but what about this Mahari? She didn't feel like using her title, and she was getting very tired of bubbles. The older woman's sleepy green eyes seemed to wake, like a cat's.
It's all right. I have the paperwork.
Fine. Then let's go.
If you couldn't figure out what else to do, you could always be rude. On the way, she turned to Sirkin.
Captain Serrano told me you'd been hurt in a brawl, and your friend was killed. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Sirkin's eyes were clouded. Brunn felt like an idiot, a cruel one. This was much harder with Mahari along. She glared at Mahari. Mahari gave her a lazy smile.
She was damn near killed herself. Don't suppose you rich girls ever have to worry about things like that. Always got protection.
That's not fair, Methlin. She was nearly killed in that mess at Cerealis.
Sirkin looked at Brunn, who suddenly realized Harris had used her own trick on her. Of course they had set up this quarrel on purpose.
Nonsense. It was her dad's place. How much danger could she be in?
Quite enough, thank you. Sirkin was there. She knows.
And you call her like a servant. Sirkin? She has a name, you know, Miss Priss.
Methlin!
It would be impolite of me to use her first name without her permission. And I don't think much of you either.
Captain told me to come. You can't make me leave.
I'm not trying to make you leave. I'm merely trying to make you observe the rudiments of polite behavior.
Brunn hoped Mahari realized she, too, was playing the role. The woman scared her.
Damn snob.
Brunn pretended not to hear it. She smiled unctuously at Sirkin.
I'm so sorry, truly. It must have been terrible for you. Captain Serrano always praised you so highly.
It was... She jumped in front of me.
Brunn felt another pang of guilt. All too clearly, she remembered how she and Rafa had felt each other's peril as well as their own.
When my friend and I were being shot at, we were as scared for each other. Once she had to shoot the man who had me at gunpoint, and she was afraid she'd hit me.
Sirkin blinked back tears. Brunn wanted to hug her.
You do understand. But your friend lived. Was that George?
George? No, not George. Rafa. She was the dark-haired one, like you.
It suddenly occurred to Brunn that Sirkin might misunderstand something here, but it was not the time to clarify the order of events and feelings.
Our stop's next!
Brunn looked up and led the way out into the concourse and then into the storage company's main office. For the next couple of hours, as the bored and contemptuous storage company workers located and unpacked half a dozen boxes from Lady Cecilia's yacht, to no avail, Mahari made sarcastic remarks about the aristocracy, and Sirkin became Brunn's natural ally. Finally, Brunn agreed that she must have been mistaken. She cheerfully handed over a credit chip to cover the extra work done on her behalf, and murmured to Sirkin that she'd really like to take her to lunch if Mahari would let her come. By then, it seemed natural that Mahari, with a few last caustic comments about the aristocracy, would head back to the crew quarters alone.
You know, if you want to talk about it, I really am a safe person to tell. I'm not quite the fluffhead I seem.
I know. Captain Serrano said you had to be pretty tough to survive on the island.
But if you don't want to, that's fine too. What's your favorite food?
After a luxurious lunch, they spent the afternoon showing why not-so-rich girls like to spend time with rich ones. Brunn found it more fun than she expected to take Sirkin to one shop after another, buying her more gifts than she could carry. She had long quit calling her Sirkin. They were Brig and Brunn. Neither mentioned Lady Cecilia that afternoon. Neither needed to. Wakening after wakening. Time lost all meaning in the dark, with only ears and nose to accept sensory data and offer meat for Cecilia's thoughts. And the only smells around were artificial, soaps and perfumes and medicines, nothing evocative of her old life. She had read about such things, but never imagined herself so cut off. She, who had been a sensualist all her life. She tried to tell herself that at least she felt no pain, but she would have traded pain for that nothingness that threatened her mind. She would not go insane. She would not give whomever had done this the satisfaction. She told herself she was lucky to be old, that the old had more memories to process, more experiences to relive. She worked her way through her own life, trying to be methodical. It was hard. She would like to have spent more time in the good years on the winning rides, when the jumps flowed by under the flashing hooves. But even in her extraordinary life, those moments were brief compared to the whole. Instead, she tried to concentrate on the duller bits.
Just how many tons of hay did I order that first winter in Hamley? How many tons of oats, of barley? Which horse required flaxseed to improve its hooves? What was the name of that farrier who slipped information to the Cosgroves? Was the third groom's name Alicia or Devra?
Not even the horses were enough. She made herself catalog her wardrobe. Not only every garment she owned now, but every garment in every closet since childhood.
Was that blue velvet robe a gift for the summer fair or winter fest? And was it Aunt Clarice or Aunt Jalora? When and where did I buy that raw silk shirt with the embroidered capelet? What happened to the Uzik skin boots or the beaded belt from Talik?
She tried to remember every room she'd walked in, placing the furniture and every ornament. She considered every investment, from the first shares of bank stock she'd bought herself, with a Winterfest gift from her grandfather. He had forbidden her to spend the money on horses, or she would have bought a new Kindle Flex saddle, to the most recent argument with her proxy. Visitors came regularly in this unnamed place. Berenice, first teary and chattery, reminded by the staff that she should not get hysterical, that she could not bring flowers or food, and her husband, Gustav, stiff, ponderous, but gentle when he touched her hand, and even young Ronnie. They talked to her, in a way. Berenice talked of their childhood. This birthday party, that incident at school, a long-forgotten playmate or servant. And she explained, at excruciating length, why she thought Cecilia had been a fool to waste all that time on horses instead of getting married, or at least working in the family. She had accepted the idea that years of small head injuries from riding had led to a massive stroke. Gustav talked of business and politics, but not in a way she could use.
What do I care if Siskan Pharmaceuticals is up 1/8 point and Barhyde Royal is down 3/4? Or if the Conservative Social Democrats have won 2 more seats in the lower house, while the Liberal Royalists have gained a critical appointment in the Bureau of Education?
Of course, Gustav had never been known for lively repartee, but even he might have realized that someone in a coma is hardly likely to understand the nuances of a field they never mastered while awake. Ronnie spent the first visit saying what she had hoped to hear, that he could not believe that his vital, strong, healthy aunt had been stricken like this. He was sure she was alert inside, listening to him, understanding him. He would never believe Captain Serrano had done this. How could she? And it would all come right in the end. But she could not communicate anything to him, could not confirm his guess. And gradually, he settled into what she thought of as useless small talk. He was no longer in exile, of course. The prince was off-planet somewhere. Rafaela had gone to visit her family before he had actually talked to her about marriage. The royals seemed rather slack after his adventures on Cerealis. George was back to being odious in the regiment, but came out of it when alone with Ronnie. This was better than Gustav, but it didn't give her much to work with when he'd gone. And none of them thought to tell her the date, the weather, or even where she was, the things that might have kept her oriented. It wasn't enough. Still, she woke into blankness, helpless and afraid, and at times could not force her mind to work through another memory. The brilliant colors of blood bay and golden chestnut, of the sunlight on a cobbled yard, or a red coat against dark woods, began to gray. She had heard of that. The deep blindness that follows blinding when the memory of color fades. She could still think yellow and red and blue and green, but the images that came were paler, almost transparent. Worst were the nightmares when she seemed to wake to a hand cold and smooth as porcelain laid along her cheek.
I did it.
Who could be so cruel?